All right, our third case is number 23-11400, Barbara Donald v. Tyler Norris. Ms. Boydston and Mr. Webb. So, Mr. Webb, you're up first.
May I please court? 7.5 minutes. In less than 7.5 minutes, Chief Norris got Mr. Burrell to the emergency room.
Well, let's talk about the decision he made before the 7.5 minutes. I haven't found anything in Alabama law, and I am certainly not an expert on Alabama law, but I haven't found anything that allowed someone in his position to release an inmate for time served. Am I wrong about that? And I know that's not the only question about his discretionary authority, but am I wrong about that?
Your Honor, there are attorney general's opinions
that say that the sheriff
does not have to house municipal
inmates.
No,
that's a different question. It's a different question if a municipal court sentences someone and says you're going to serve 60 days in that jail. I understand that absent contractual arrangements, the sheriff who is in charge of that jail may not have to take that inmate. I get that. But once you've accepted the inmate, does a sheriff have any authority under Alabama law to release an inmate for time served before the sentence is up?
Your Honor, I do not know, and there is no case law one way or another.
If you don't know, then there's no authority.
But the Attorney General's opinion certainly would suggest that.
It sounds crazy to think that a county sheriff or his or her deputy in charge of a jail could release an inmate for time served before that sentence is up. Right? That just makes no sense.
I understand, Your Honor. It is our position that does not matter with the inquiry into discretionary authority.
Why is that?
Your Honor, if I can give some context.
No, let me tell you my concern and why I think some of the issues we asked you to talk about, whether you have to look at the bundle of actions taken for the discretionary function prong. But here's where I think there might be a link of some sorts. If he released him, he ordered him released for time served, and that happened before he picked him up, right? The record is undisputed about
release,
that.
The actual release, Your Honor, it's a computer entry, and that was done on the way to the hospital.
That was done when?
On the way to the hospital, Your Honor.
So he had instructed, though, he had instructed someone to begin the release process.
Yes.
He puts his clothes on, he picks him up, then the formal release occurs when they're in the car. Is that how it works?
Yes. The actual release occurs after.
But I think in fairness, like, I mean, I take Judge Jordan's point to be the release process began before he picked him up.
Yes, with the sheriff.
With the changing of the clothes and whatever, right?
Yes, the changing of the clothes, yes.
So I guess the question I have is this how we have historically done discretionary authority? Like, we slice and dice. It seems like that's not even the way this case was presented. The district court sort of injects this parsing into the case, and I'm just not, it just doesn't make any sense to me that in a claim for deliberate indifference to medical needs, that the release really has much to do with it. I mean, I'll have to confess, and I'll ask your adversary about this, there's a piece of me that thinks this guy deserves a medal, not a lawsuit.
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, even the bottom of page 3 of the district court's opinion states that Norris decided it was in Burrell's best interest to take him to the hospital rather than calling for an ambulance. He took himself off duty, drove hastily to the jail, picked him up, and just tore off toward the hospital.
So, like, I get all that, and I guess at the risk, what I don't want to do is slip into advocate mode. So let me ask you just the sort of the cold question. In terms of precedent, how do we typically approach questions of discretionary authority? Sort of holistically or on a slice and dice method? And I'm not trying to load that question. I genuinely want to know. I'll ask your adversary as well.
Holistically.
Okay. So tell me about that.
Of course, the Holloman case says general nature. But if you look at the Harvard International versus James, this court said when a governmental official goes completely outside the scope of his discretionary authority, he ceases to act as a governmental official and instead acts entirely on his own behalf. And then it goes on. Once a government official acts entirely on his own behalf, okay, acting on his own behalf would say, I'm off duty, you call for an ambulance. Acting on his own behalf, the policies underlying the doctrine of qualified immunity no longer support its application. For that reason, if a government official is acting wholly outside the scope of his discretionary authority, he is not entitled to qualified immunity, regardless of whether the law in a given area was clearly established. Also, this court in that opinion cited to N. Ray Allen, the Fourth Circuit decision, where it says he cannot claim qualified immunity if he acts totally beyond the scope, totally.
Can I give you a hypothetical from a case I sat on many years ago where we did not decide the question? Georgia case, and it goes to Judge Newsom's question about how you view discretionary authority. Georgia case. Police officer did not do his firearm certification training. And Georgia law said, if you don't complete that training on a yearly basis, you are not authorized to use a firearm as a law enforcement officer. Police officer who did not complete the training uses the firearm and kills somebody. Does he act within the scope of his discretionary authority in that circumstance?
Your Honor, you have to look at the...
He's acting as a police officer. The Georgia law doesn't say you stop being a police officer. What it says is you cannot use a firearm until you complete that firearms training every single year.
I will answer it by citing to the U.S. Supreme Court case of Davis versus Scheer, where the Supreme Court stated officials sued for constitutional violations do not lose their qualified immunity merely because their conduct violates some statutory or administrative provision.
That's a different question, though.
But, Your Honor, that
for
is...
For better or for worse, and I know you've made the argument to the contrary, but our precedent says that there is a prong of the qualified immunity analysis that the defendant has to satisfy first, and that's that he or she was acting within the scope of his or her discretionary authority. So my question is, what do you do with a hypothetical like the one that I gave you? Do you take the police officer acting as a police officer as a whole, or do you take the police officer using the firearm in a statutorily unauthorized way?
You have to take it, and Harper points this out, about you have to look at the factual context. And that is where you get into split-second decisions.
No.
If that officer...
That goes to the question of whether or not there's been a constitutional violation under the deliberate indifference standard, or whether or not the law might be clearly established. It doesn't go to discretionary function. Those are separate inquiries. I know you think that we're wrong as a circuit in having that at step one. But I think for us as a panel, I think you're stuck with that regime.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm not arguing. I understand that's not for this
whether
panel.
Whether or not you're making a split-second decision doesn't go to whether or not you were acting within the scope of your discretionary authority. it goes to whether or not you should be given immunity at the end of the day, but not to step one.
Your Honor, there wasn't the luxury of time to determine whether the sheriff's direction was lawful or not. So, Your Honor, from that standpoint, a subordinate does have the authority to act and take care of the important matter, the general nature, get him medical care.
So let me ask you, so separate and aside from Judge Jordan's hypothetical, what about this case of ours called Estate of Cummings? Are you familiar with this
yes,
case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where a similar argument was made, where the defendant says general nature, and the court says, well, wait a minute. The fact that you've got, I'm paraphrasing, of course, but the fact that you've got general authority to make medical decisions for inmates doesn't mean you can pull the plug on someone, right? So they sort of drilled down to a slightly more granular level of detail. And so to Judge Jordan's question, why not likewise here?
They did, Your Honor. But in that case, they said that there was a clear statute that categorically removed him from having any authority in this matter.
Well, I think Judge Jordan would say, isn't there some statute or case law or something that says that only courts get to release prisoners and sheriffs don't?
As far as municipal courts, no, Your Honor, there is not.
Okay.
At the end of the day,
I mean, just correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, the way a sentence works in Alabama is when the sentence is over, the sheriff releases the person, right, from the jail.
Yes, Your
Honor. And here the problem, if it is a problem, is that the sheriff just didn't wait for the sentence to be over.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
But here the problem, if there's a problem, it's not that the sheriff usually doesn't release people from the jail. It's usually his job to release people from jail. The problem is that he didn't wait for the sentence to be over before he released him from the jail, if that's right, that's the alleged problem?
Yes, Your Honor. He released him.
Okay. So let's talk about, I'll give him a couple of more minutes too, please. So let's talk about the deliberate indifference portion of this. You said 7.5 minutes, which I think is, had done or had a clerk do the actual timeline to see the date, the times. But in any event, if he decided to drive him to a class one medical facility 40 minutes away, would he have been acting in a deliberately indifferent manner?
No, Your Honor.
2 hours away.
Possibly, Your Honor. But it depends on the...
See, it's not just the choice. It's the facts surrounding the choice. And you may be right at the end of the day that either there's no constitutional violation or he gets qualified immunity. But the choice in and of itself doesn't give him qualified immunity. The choice to drive him to the hospital himself, in my view, I don't speak for my colleagues, can't get him qualified immunity, because if that choice had been drive him to, despite the breathing problems, the really, really high blood pressure, he was at 240 over 165. If he decides 2.5 hours away is good, I'm going to drive him 2.5 hours away. I'm not sure that he doesn't meet the deliberate indifference bar, as opposed to calling for an ambulance or 911.
Your Honor, that's not what we have here.
I know here. It's not. Of course it's not. I started by talking about your 7.5 minute framing of the issue. So my question is, does it matter where he took him and the amount of time that it took him to get there?
It could, depending on the circumstances. But getting medical care is what he did, and that is what he decided it was in his best interest to drive him to the emergency room. And acting in an inmate's best interest is the antithesis of deliberate indifference.
All right, now you say it's 7.5 minutes, and the time, given that we're dealing with somewhere in the 7 to 10 to 11 minute range, it may not matter at the end of the day, but he decides while he's in his car going home, that it's in Burrell's best interest for Norris to take him to the hospital. That happens at around 8:59 or 9 p.m., right?
Your Honor, 8:59 was when the nurse was called. That's how we know from her cell phone records, 8:59. Now, while on the phone with the nurse and with Chief Norris, who pulled over, they took blood pressure in the left arm, took it in the right arm, which takes time. So by the time that this happened and the nurse said, get him to the ER, which the nurse submitted a declaration saying, by that I mean drive him to the emergency room, don't call and wait around for an ambulance. So it probably would have been around 9:02 by the time.
At what time does he decide? Your client decide that he is going to do it himself?
At about 9:02 and plus some change, I guess, Your Honor.
Okay, so 9:02.
Probably 9:02 and a half.
And he gets him to the hospital right around 9:10, which accounts for your 7.5 minute.
Yes, control, Your Honor.
Right?
Okay. It was at or before 9:10.
You've got 1 minute to wrap up if you'd like, and you can save your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. It is our position that when considering Norris's conduct, whether Norris's conduct fell within the scope of his discretionary authority for qualified immunity purposes, this court should assess his actions in the aggregate, should follow this court's precedent in Holloman versus Harland regarding the general nature, and it should be examined on a general level rather than in this specific application, which is a quote from Harland. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you very much. Ms. Boydston.
May it please the court, Julian Boydston for the appellee. Timing absolutely matters. The Eighth Amendment does not allow for a government official to delay medical care for a serious medical condition such as a heart attack. And in regards to a heart attack specifically, minutes matter.
So let me ask you a question. I guess if we're going to talk briefly about the merits of the deliberate indifference claim, do you think there's a strong argument that if Norris had done nothing, right, he was off on his way home, If he had fielded the call and said, deal with it yourself, I'm on my way home to my wife and kids, do you think that's deliberate indifference?
Your Honor, it could be.
Really? I don't think so. I mean, you think that's criminally reckless? What responsibility was it of his at that point?
I think it certainly depends more on detailed facts, like whether or not there was someone at the jail who could make the decision whether to get to call 911.
Well, wasn't there a nurse who called him?
So yes, Your Honor.
There is someone at the jail.
You're right.
Capable of calling 911.
That's correct.
And so if he does nothing, if he goes home, he's not liable. And instead, if he turns around and, you know, sort of takes dramatic action to get the guy to the hospital, he is liable?
Your Honor, I think it still depends on more details that we don't have. So on those bare facts, I think that is an easier question, perhaps. However, if he just tells the nurse, you know, deal with it, I'm going home, and then the nurse can't get an ambulance on the scene, and then there isn't anyone to take him, it might be a different factual situation there. So I think it does depend, and that's certainly not what happened here.
That's definitely not what happened here. I guess the question for me is whether what happened here is cause for condemnation or commendation.
Yes, Your Honor. So the facts in this case certainly show that it's not for to give Norris an award. In fact, Norris was preoccupied with the cost to the county, and that's what cost Ms. Burrell his life. It was not a heroic theme. And even if it was, precedence in this circuit tells us that even if there was a good faith effort taken and the actions were still unreasonable to a serious medical need, that can constitute deliberate indifference. That's in the LaMarca v. Turner case, as well as the Maley v. Maley v. Prison Health, I think, which is a Southern District of Georgia case.
I guess setting aside the discretionary authority issue, which I know we're going to have to get into, I mean, frankly, I think this case would be pretty easy if somehow we can bypass all this discretionary authority stuff and just decide the case on the merits, because to me, it's a pretty easy case that there was no deliberate indifference here, just speaking for myself. The difficulty is that we've got to deal with this discretionary authority thing because of the procedural posture of the case. It's on appeal here from a denial of summary judgment. The only way we have appellate jurisdiction is to address qualified immunity. And for better or worse, there's this discretionary judgment thing we've got to deal with first, right? If this had been a grant of summary judgment and we have the case on the flip side, we could just go straight through to the merits and decide whether or not there was deliberate indifference. But, so with respect to discretionary authority, Did you plead the case in your complaint this way, sort of slicing and dicing as I described it?
Yes, Your Honor. We pled three independent acts. So the release was pled, I believe, in paragraph 24 through 26, 31, and 35 through 37. So it's pled as an independent act for a constitutional violation. And to the question of whether, you know, we do have to address discretionary authority because a government official is only eligible for qualified immunity if, as we've discussed with my colleague, whether they're acting within their scope of discretionary authority.
So what's your best authority? I asked your adversary what his best authority was. What's your best authority for the notion that we should sort of slice, dice, parse, squint to divvy up aggregate actions this way?
And yes, Your Honor.
I'll tell you in advance, my concern is that if you look too closely, my guess is that in every situation, you'll be able to find some I that wasn't dotted, some T that wasn't crossed, and then your position is that ruins discretionary authority for everything.
I hear you, Your Honor, and fortunately, that is not the situation, and that's not my position. This court's precedent in Hallman v. Harlan, which my colleague mentioned, as well as the Cummings v. Davenport case, tells us that there is a definitive two-pronged test that answers this simply. And the first prong, as we know, is whether the action was undertaken pursuant to a job-related function, one that would be within Mr. Norris's job description. And then the second is whether it was done so essentially within a tool that he had to use in his toolbox. Now, when addressing those inquiries, the court looks to state law. And here,
So just so I'm tracking, though, isn't a lot of the debate here going to be about what the nature of the action is, right? If the action is release, okay, whoa, this is real complicated. Not sure whether he's got the authority to do that. If the action is take care of this guy, totally different sort of perspective.
Your Honor, I think that you'd be right, and that would be a difficult question. However, the evidence in this case tells us that's not the question, because Mr. Norris testified on page 113 of his deposition that the release had no purpose for medical care. So that answers that question with a period. In fact, he even says that the release was not necessary, not only for medical care, but he didn't need to change out of his jail uniform and into civilian clothes for the release. So this is a step that's completely unrelated to getting treatment through an ambulance or at the hospital or relating to any kind of quality of care. Yeah. There's nothing in the record that attaches the act of the release to Mr. Norris's asserted authority for medical care.
Can you answer this question for me? Because I think you're right about that they're completely distinct. But that just seems like that's kind of a problem for me, because it seems like you're suing over the denial of medical care, the delay in receiving medical care. But the thing that you're pointing to say that he didn't have the authority to do is the release, which seems to be just a separate issue. How are those things connected, given the nature of your claim?
Yes, Your Honor. So the release caused a delay in the medical care. And we know from this circuit's precedence that a delay of mere minutes can matter for a significant medical condition such as a heart attack. And we have expert testimony establishing that because of the release, because of the walking that needed to happen from the cell to the changing room to the Tahoe that Mr. Norris drove, in addition to changing in and out of his jail clothes and into his civilian clothes, that caused...
But these things, though, even if he not released him from jail,
even if he had not filled out the paperwork and he had just said, hey, you, come get in my car and wouldn't drive to the hospital, he would have still done all that.
Right? Yes, Your Honor, and that's attached to the decision not to call 911. And
yeah, well, so, okay, so you got the decision. I mean, and this is where it seems like your deliberate indifference claim is he drove him to the hospital instead of calling 911. The release is just this, like, other thing that happened. It's like a paperwork thing that happened. Let's just assume for me, as a hypothetical, I realize this is not this case, but assume for me just this hypothetical that he never released him, that he just said, okay, I hear you're having a heart attack, chained into civilian clothes and hop in my car and I'm going to drive you to the hospital, and then he dies on the way to the hospital. Would your claim be different at all?
No, Your Honor, because he would still be required, I believe under those facts, he would still be required to change out of his clothes.
Yeah.
Which, you know, has the causation of worsening his symptoms and then delaying treatment. And then the decision to get him into the car, having him just walk to the car and drive to that is still a measure to avoid medical costs.
Right. So I think that's exactly right. And so that's my point, is how does the authority to effectuate a release actually sign the documents and say your sentence is up? How does that really have anything to do with your claim if you would have exactly the same claim if he had never done that?
Well, because I do think that the failing to call 911 and the private transport were kind of ancillary measures, additional measures to make sure that the hospital didn't think that the jail was responsible, but really the release was the mechanism to avoid. So I think that's the best I can answer that question.
But so just if I can follow up, because I had the exact same question. I mean, if release, the act of release is just a formality, it's a bookkeeping entry, basically, that you allege he didn't have authority to do, how is that causally related? The release itself, how is that causally related to any injury that he suffered?
Because it did trigger his exertion.
The pushing of the button that says you're formally released, the thing that you say he had no authority to do?
The decision to do that. Yes. The reason why he was required to change clothes was because of the release.
But Judge Brasher is asking you, what about if he never said push the button and release the guy? He just said, look, have him change into some civilian clothes and meet me, and I'll take him to the hospital. Isn't your claim exactly the same?
I think I see your point, Your Honor. But I still would stand that it's still three independent acts. I'm not reluctant to concede anything.
I understand. I mean, I this goes to my concern that you're always going to be able to find some I that wasn't dotted or some T that wasn't crossed. I mean, we could come up with all sorts of goofy hypotheticals about things less goofy than Judge Jordan's hypo from the earlier case about not going through the firearms training. That seems like kind of substantive. But
can I give you a goofy hypothetical?
Yeah.
Let me give you a goofy hypothetical. Let's say a state adopts a statute that says no state officer has the discretionary authority to violate the Constitution or to violate the constitutional rights of any citizens. And anything that a state officer does that violates the constitutional rights of citizens shall be null and void. Is there no qualified immunity anymore? Because every constitutional claim will therefore collapse?
That is certainly a harder hypothetical, Your Honor. However, I do think that would actually conflict with this court's precedence of when you apply this discretionary authority analysis, that you only remove the unconstitutional taint. In Judge Jordan's hypothetical, I will say that my answer would be that if there is a state law requirement regarding gun use and an official does not meet that requirement, then I think you answered the second prong of the discretionary authority, which is that you don't have the means to do so. Because in the Cummings case that we talked about, yeah. You know, the Alabama...
I thought that would be your answer to his hypothetical, but your answer to my hypothetical is what?
Your Honor, I'm not certain. If you could rephrase it, I could try again.
You answered it, which is our law says you don't look at...
That's right.
How the function was exercised in an unconstitutional manner.
Correct.
You look at the function. Was someone authorized to arrest? Was someone authorized to use deadly force? And you don't look and see whether or not those functions were exercised, to take the hypothetical, in an unconstitutional manner, at least for the discretionary function prong.
Correct, Judge Jordan. And to that point, this case does expound on that really well in Holloman v. Harland, and actually cautioned against applying a high level of generality. Judge Newsom, I know you're concerned with having the risk of generality when you zoom in, but the same has been warned against in the circuit since the 80s about zooming out. And an aggregate view of acts would do exactly that. Because if you're going to bundle the release, the failure to call 911, the private transport into a group of three, and then you'd have to take multiple steps backwards and squint to have one result from three acts that require two questions each. So really six determinations.
On the merits, to push back a little bit on Judge Newsom's perspective, as I understood the district court's order and your briefing on the issue, it's not just the amount of time that it took to get Mr. Burrell to the hospital. It's his inability, because of the decision made, to get any emergency medical care before he was transported to the hospital. I mean, 911 personnel usually have some options available to them for someone who is maybe beginning to experience a heart attack or something else like that. And here, the decision to transport him by Mr. Norris, whether at the end of the day was a constitutional violation or not, certainly impacted Mr. Burrell's ability, in this case inability, to get any other medical care for his condition for a period of time.
Yes, Your Honor. All the decisions that Mr. Norris made certainly foreclosed the possibility of medical care earlier. And as the record shows us, the jail is only located one block from the ambulance station. And so if Norris had just called 911, he would have been able to learn whether there was an ambulance available, which could have been there between 1 and 2 minutes. And we know that from Kevin Smith's testimony. He was the owner of the ambulance company. But he didn't call.
My reaction to this case would be different if that one call had been made, not by Mr. Norris, but by the nurse or somebody at the jail. Hey, call and see if an ambulance is available or an EMT unit is available. And if the answer were no, it's not, then I completely agree with Judge Newsom that this is not a deliberate indifference case, because then he is doing something heroic to try to get him to the hospital when nobody else can get him there in a quicker period of time and nobody can provide him medical care.
Do you mind if I ask
a
question?
No, not at all.
So you haven't talked about the state law claim, and y'all filed a motion previously to cancel this. There were several motions to try to cancel this oral argument. Your most recent motion to cancel the oral argument was on the basis of the state law issue. Could you just address your state law claim before you sit down?
Yes, Your Honor. I'll do my best. So we have two arguments as to why Norris is not entitled to absolute state immunity. The first is that this court has never intended to only construe the sixth exception of ex parte Moulton not to apply to constitutional officers. So we can go through the lineage, and I do so in the briefing, before and after ex parte Moulton. And it certainly is muddied by the Alabama Supreme Court.
And so it's my understanding that the most recent case is the Birmingham Broadcasters case, where the Alabama Supreme Court didn't apply it in the sense of found that the exception existed, but applied it in the sense of evaluated whether the facts met that exception.
That's correct. They also did so in Gaines v. Smith, which I believe is also a recent case, 2022.
Okay.
So we have those two indications from the Alabama Supreme Court that ex parte Moulton sixth exception is intended to apply. And then additionally, the case of Pinkard, ex parte Pinkard, which I believe is a 2020 case.
Which if I understand right, Pinkard is an even broader argument.
Correct.
that basically state agent immunity just doesn't really exist really in its current form in Alabama anymore, right?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that, but
okay.
Your Honor, I would say ex parte Pinkard stands for the principle that simply because a liability arises from a duty that could be construed within the scope of authority does not necessarily mean that government official is wrapped up in absolute immunity. That's because if you're sued individually, not your official capacity, Pinkard stands for the principle that unless it affects the state coffers or state contract, then it's really not against the state of Alabama.
So just to sum up, my understanding of your arguments on this is you have a broader argument, which is, I guess I would call your Pinkard argument, and then the narrow argument, which is that there's an exception. To the extent that agent immunity exists in a different form, there's an exception that would apply here, this sixth exception.
That's correct.
The district court, what did the district court do on this?
The district court found that Mr. Norris was not entitled to state immunity. I do think the court mentioned the Jailers Protection Act and state agency. I think there was some confusion about whether this was raised by the appellant. I'm sure they're going to contradict that. And so the court found he was not immune through state immunity.
Right.
Okay. Can I ask you one more just housekeeping item? I promise this isn't a hard question.
Okay.
So the district court sort of disaggregates the three pieces of conduct. It says, I'm not going to consider qualified immunity with respect to the release, but I will consider qualified immunity with respect to the transportation, right? Does he ever, in his qualified immunity analysis, address the question whether the law was clearly established?
Yes, Your Honor. In his opinion, he points to a few cases. Ancona versus Prison Health, which was a 1985 case where the jail refused to send a detainee to a doctor outside the jail unless there was a court order because the jail wanted the detainee to pay for it, as well as Harris v. Coweta County, which is a 1994 case, which the jail ignored without explanation a serious medical need that was obvious, and the court found deliberate indifference in that case.
I guess I just want to make sure, and I might just be misremembering, but does he sort of like tag the base of saying, I have found that there's a violation, and now on to step two, this was clearly established within the meaning of Harlow versus Fitzgerald or whatever?
Okay. Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, okay.
Yes. For those reasons, we ask the court to affirm the district court.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, the release did not cause any delay. He came directly to the jail, picked him up. They were in the Sallyport within 4 seconds of each other. When he came out, put in his car, immediately taken. And you have to understand, Clark County is the third largest county area-wise in Alabama. Ambulance service in rural Alabama counties is not very good. It's, to be honest, unreliable. The jail has experienced that. An inmate died a little over 2 months before this incident while waiting on an ambulance. In February of the same year, just about 9 months earlier, they had called for an ambulance. The guy was suffering from a heart attack. It was 6 minutes later when the ambulance says, oh, we've got to now dispatch somebody from the city of Jackson.
But here no phone call was made to find out whether or not an ambulance was available.
You're right. Due to their experience with the ambulance service, they determined it was best to take him to the emergency room.
They didn't determine. Mr. Norris determined.
He did, yes. And the nurse also did a declaration saying, that's exactly what I meant when I said take him to the ER. You go driving. Don't wait for an ambulance. The nurse also complained in her deposition about how unreliable the ambulance service is. If it's a true emergency, take them. And that's what they did.
How far was the ambulance service from the jail?
We don't know.
We don't know anywhere.
We don't know where the
ambulance. She just said it was across the street. So what?
No,
I'm not asking about where a hypothetical ambulance unit might have been at the time. I'm asking about the physical location of the ambulance facility related to the jail.
There are three physical locations.
Okay.
City of Jackson, City of Thomasville, and Grove Hill. Okay. Grove Hill is in between Thomasville and to the south of Thomasville, north of City of Jackson. There are not always three ambulances on
duty. Yeah, okay. Was there one, like, right next to the jail?
a block away, there was one. We don't know if anybody was there. Okay. We don't know.
Let me get you to address this, because this is my best case for the other side argument that the release is what caused this problem. Okay, and I want you to address this, because to me it's the strongest, in my mind, the strongest argument for the other side, is that when the sheriff faced this decision, the jailer, they call him and they say, we have someone, he's having a medical emergency, what do we do? He has two options. One, to call an ambulance, in which case they will pick him up at the jail, they will take him to the hospital, he will be an inmate of the jail, the county will have to cover his medical costs, the ambulance ride, things like that. The other option is to release him and to get him to a hospital himself. And when he's faced with that choice, he chooses option B because it's cheaper for the county if he's just released and he gets to the hospital in some other way. So if that's the best argument for why the release is related to the medical care. So what do you say about that?
Well, Your Honor, the number one, the ambulance service, as far as the delay, when they looked at the records from 2010 to 2015, there are no instances where an ambulance could get there in 7.5 minutes. None. None within 10
minutes. Okay, that's non-responsive. But
secondly, with respect to releasing him, whether he changed clothes or not, that didn't, to be honest, it didn't factor into his thought process. His thought process was get him to the ER as soon as possible.
Why? I understand that legally there may be causation issues or whatever, but if release didn't matter, why did he order him released?
Again, relaying what the sheriff said. When the sheriff said it, he did it.
No. I'm asking you. He's your client.
Yes,
if release doesn't matter, why did he release him? If release didn't matter, why didn't he just say, meet me at the Sally Port, I'm going to take him in his prison clothes, and let's go?
Because a lot of times sheriffs do release him.
Because he's no longer an inmate, and when he gets, again, putting the best spin on the evidence in the light most favorable to the other side, because when he gets to the jail with him, he's like, who is he? He's a free guy, just got out of jail, but he's having some trouble breathing. The jail's not on the hook for him anymore.
It's similar to the policy that was at issue in Marsh versus Butler County, where the policy of the sheriff was to release inmates that had medical issues. Did he get court orders? Or did she get court orders? The answer is no. But the sheriff had that policy.
I mean, it seems to me that in response to Judge Jordan's question, you just need to shoot straight. Your guy testified to it and say, look, they released him to save the money. In any event, that release, the act of release had nothing to do with the harm the guy suffered.
It doesn't.
It's a really stinky fact for your side. Like, this whole release him to save costs is just gross. But does it have anything to do with the harm that he suffered?
No, Your Honor. It had nothing to do with the harm he suffered. It released him to, it saved money. It would have been the city of Jackson's money.
Just say so and say it doesn't matter. Sometimes lawyers are stuck with really bad facts that they don't make up, that the record creates for them, and you just deal with it and you move on. But you can't just say that or suggest that the release was of no moment to anybody for no reason whatsoever, because there was a reason why he wanted him in street clothes.
Yes, Your Honor.
But did he choose that? And here goes back to my question. Did he choose that decision? Did he say, I'm going to release him instead of calling the ambulance to save money?
No.
And if he did that, then isn't the release related to that course of action and the medical care that he received?
Your Honor, he could have called an ambulance and then released him. That had nothing to do with the decision whether to take him to the hospital or call and wait for an ambulance.
He could have released him, called an ambulance, and said, the ambulance is going to pick you up outside.
Yes. Right.
Can, 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 let me ask you one other question. We've been talking about calling or not calling an ambulance, and I'm certainly not familiar with Alabama counties, but or like an EMT fire rescue available, is that the same thing as an ambulance? Different? I mean, in some places, calling an ambulance is different than calling 911 for an emergency rescue squad to come over and try to perform some sort of triage while an ambulance comes to get the person.
If I can get some background first,
sure.
You would call 911. 911 then would call the ambulance dispatch. Okay? Then the ambulance dispatch would dispatch the ambulance. The ambulances, they typically would have a paramedic on duty. However, as the owner said, sometimes they didn't have a paramedic and they would do an EMT instead, which there is a difference with respect to the drugs that they can administer on the ambulance. If they did not have paramedic for three locations or even an ambulance service, but if they had two paramedics, one EMT, they would always put the EMT in Grove Hill, okay, because that's the least populated area. They would put the paramedics in the more populated areas. Also, if they didn't have enough staff to even have three ambulances, they would have there are two ambulances. They would have them in Thomasville and in Jackson. They would not have it in Grove Hill.
So there's no separate fire rescue?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
So state law claim. So the district court says you don't get state agent immunity as opposed to respect to their state law claim. What do you say about that?
Well, Your Honor, we raised state immunity, and the court never addressed state immunity, but instead addressed the jailer immunity under 14-6-1. And that's not what we actually raised, and that is what we have brought before this court. We are entitled to the protections of the state immunity.
Well, let me ask you this. This is the way this was litigated. You, in your initial brief, say we get state agent immunity. In their response brief, they say no, you don't, because of Exception 6. And then I didn't see anywhere in your reply brief where you actually said that you would not have met Exception 6. You just say Exception 6 doesn't exist.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, in tracing back to Parker versus Amerson and the cases since then, including Ex parte Burrell, it just includes those five elements. However, even if, and by the way, in a case before the Birmingham News case, I believe it's the Perot case, they said, no, the sixth thing, the sheriffs and deputies are different, okay? And so it did not apply that in that case, and that was an earlier case. There's a conflict in the Alabama Supreme Court. That's why they're addressing it now. But even if there is now a sixth element for constitutional officers, then even then, he didn't act in bad faith.
You never said that in your brief, though. I mean, I think I'm right about that. You never said that at all in your brief.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.